Certain names get burned into the collective memory of society. Columbine is one of those. That is the high school in Colorado where a pair of students opened fire with multiple guns in April 1999. When it was over, 12 students and a teacher had been shot dead. 24 other people suffered injuries. The shooters, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, killed themselves before police could reach them. Our guest this hour knows the story as well as anybody. Dylan Klebold was her son, and she had no idea he was capable of the kind of violence he wrought that day. Sue Klebold wrote the book A Mother's Reckoning, now out in paperback. By her request, we have opted to not take any phone calls this hour. That was a condition of getting the interview. Sue Klebold, thank you for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
So no one would have faulted you for not wanting to come out in public. Why have you?
Well, it's taken a very long time for me to be able to do this. When people have a family member who does something horrible, who hurts other people, it is a great burden and humiliation. It causes a lot of fear, certainly. And what finally overrided all those reservations was my need to share what I had learned, my need to talk about how someone's thinking deteriorates to a point where they can do something like this. And I felt that it was a necessary thing to do, that it was something that people needed to know about, that we can't just put a caricature on somebody who commits atrocities like this and dehumanize them, because they are very human, and they're very vulnerable, as we all are, and we need to do a better job of making sure that these things don't happen.
Well, the trepidation you felt about coming forward, you had a chance to find out what was actually going to happen with the release of the original hardcover version of the book a year ago. What was the range of responses you got?
In order to survive this for myself, I have surrounded myself with people who are very kind and protective of me. So I was only able to see the positive and supported comments. And from what I could tell from the book sales, from the comments that I was getting, that I was surprised. But people were receptive. They were listening. They were saying that they had learned something, that it had changed their thinking. So from what I am able to tell and from anything that I've seen, it was well received and people have been kind and open-minded.
Lest anybody think you're making money from tragedy, Sue Klebold, what are you doing with the book profits?
All of my share of the profits are going to organizations that support mental health and work to prevent suicide.
All of them?
All of them. All of my share of the profits.
There's a key quote early in the book where you write, "Persistent thoughts of death and suicide are symptoms of pathology, not of flawed character." Can you expand on that a bit?
Yes. The more I investigated, it took me a very long time to understand what had happened with Dylan, because like everyone else, I was confused. I was hearing news reports. Much of the information was false, was wrong in the beginning. And it took me a long, long time to try to understand the importance of the fact that Dylan had killed himself during this tragedy. Many months after this happened, I was able to see some of his writings. They had been held by the police. I had not seen them until long after his death. And I could see that his thinking was beginning to become unhealthy probably 2 years before this happened. He was beginning to talk about wishing he could die, wanting to get a gun so that he could kill himself. He mentioned, he talked a lot about being in agony and suffering. He mentioned cutting himself. These were things he was experiencing privately, hiding from his family and his friends. And over time and after talking with many experts, I finally came to understand that in Dylan's case, I believe he participated in this tragedy because of his suicidality as much as any other reason. He wanted to end his pain and wanted to die. And I began to examine the suicidal mind and how impaired we can be in our thinking and our reasoning and our logic when we are in an extremely suicidal state.
You say Dylan didn't share what he was feeling with family or close friends. So where was he expressing himself?
Well, I think he had made a few entries in some, I won't call it a journal because it wasn't a journal, There were pieces of paper found in his school books and his notebooks where he would occasionally write about what he was experiencing. But what really happened toward the end of his life was that he had a very close bond with another very disturbed boy. Eric Harris was a really disturbed kid, and it was even his own doctor, he was under a doctor's care, was not aware of Eric's thinking, but there was some kind of chemistry. They were very different kids. They were experiencing very different kinds of thoughts and feelings, but I think probably through experiences that they'd shared, they bonded with each other and began to act out this cruel, awful fantasy that became a reality.
Have you ever had conversations since the events in April 1999 with Eric Harris's parents?
I have, and as with every family member I talk to who is a family member of someone who has been involved in a mass shooting, I always protect their privacy and protect these conversations, because coming forward and being a public person after your child has done something like this is extremely difficult, and no one could, I hope, expect that because it's too difficult. My choice to do this was something I felt that I had to do based on my years. I was a teacher for years, and I saw this as a teaching opportunity. But most people, and I've talked to quite a few parents, and they choose to not be public and not be in the limelight at all.
Did that, I mean, obviously different choice with your ex-husband, now ex-husband, Tom.
Yes.
Was he dead set against coming out in public himself?
I won't use the words dead set, but we certainly differed in our opinions about how to process this, because we're completely different people. I'm more of an extroverted person. I have a teaching background. I am a sort of a coalition builder. I take comfort from finding a tribe and interacting and connecting with other people. And he's more of an introvert and values his privacy greatly. So, yes, we went in two completely different directions.
More from Sue Klebold, who wrote the book A Mother's Reckoning. Dylan Klebold was her son. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking with Sue Klebold today. The last name should ring a bell. It probably will for generations of Americans for generations to come. Her son, Dylan Klebold, with Eric Harris, were the two shooters at Columbine High School in 1999, killing 12 students and a teacher and wounding 24 others before killing themselves. Sue Klebold's book is called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. And she has requested that we not take any phone calls during the segment today as a condition of getting the interview, and we have honored that request. I noticed, Sue, you recently spoke at a TED Talk kind of thing, but it was a TED Med event. I mean, so you really do see this as a medical kind of story.
Yes, I do, and I'm not the only one who sees it that way, because the TED Med organization invited me to speak because they felt that the topic was a relevant component of brain health.
So even understanding brain health and understanding pathology better over time, I mean, it seems like there are still lots of people willing to lay issues with children on the training given by or the lack given by their parents. I imagine you've gotten a face full of that in the last few years.
Oh, yes. Yes. Of course, every situation is different. My exploration, the answers that I was trying to seek answers to, that was said poorly, but I wanted to know why my son was there, how Dylan could have been there, because I knew that I had done everything within my power to raise a loving and moral and ethical child, and there were no guns in our home. I tried to prevent him from seeing violent movies, you know, until he was of age where he was able to do that. There were 1,000 things that I tried to teach him to make him a kind and responsible human being. And I couldn't understand if there was something I had done to make this happen, if there was some negligence on my part, or perhaps the opposite, was I too strict? So there were years of self-examination of, you know, I was in therapy. I went through all kinds of work to try to understand, you know, in what ways had I contributed to this? Had, you know, what was happening? And what I eventually learned, and I became involved with the suicide prevention community and got to know a lot of individuals who had lost loved ones to suicide or who had themselves attempted suicide and survived. And when I began to understand that the suicidal mind and how impaired one can be when one is in an extreme state of crisis, it sort of put these pieces together for me, and I began to look at Dylan's death and the last hours of his life as something where he was himself a victim of what was going on in his mind.
So you mentioned in the book you have asked yourself the question, what could we have done differently? Is there anything at this point that you think, well, okay, I could have seen that sooner or something like that?
Yes. The one thing that I really strongly believe that I could have done differently, and this is why I wanted to write about this and talk about it, is I wish I had listened to Dylan differently. What I always say to parents is the most important thing you can do as a parent is to shut up and listen. Now, of course, I talked with Dylan. I said, how are you feeling? You seem tired today. You know, do you want a sandwich? I was nurturing, but I don't think I ever in my life tried to find the words that would give him an opportunity to speak to me in a way where I would just listen and not try to fix it. I think when our children come to us with their problems and their issues, we are very quick to try to want to pull them out of their pain. We will come to quick fixes and say, well, you know, we'll get you help with this, or it's just, you'll feel better tomorrow. And I think the thing that I regret the most is not just listening and saying, you know, tell me more about that and how do you feel about that. I once asked a psychiatrist, is there anything parents can say to their kids to get this conversation started? And he suggested, say something like, tell me something about yourself that no one understands but that causes you pain. And then he said, whatever they say, whether it's I don't want to talk about it or whether they start to open up, your only response should be, tell me more about that. And I regret that I did not know to do that. I did not know how to be able to live with the pain that he was feeling and make him feel comfortable talking about it and sharing it. And I think that is the one thing that I regret the most.
So tell me more rather than snap out of it or you'll be fine or
right,
anything
or, you
else.
Know, yeah. You're not pulling your weight. I mean, what we as parents do is we're trying to mold responsible adults, you know, and we talk about, as I certainly did with Dylan, you know, you didn't do what I asked you, you know, you're not helping the family. I don't ever recall just sitting down and saying, you know, I'm going to just sit here and just let you say whatever you want to say. And I'm not going to insert my own feelings, my own thoughts, and fill up the silence with words. That's my deepest regret.
Sue Klebold is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy, Tragedy at Columbine High School in 1999, caused by her son Dylan and Eric Harris. Dylan was in some kind of a legal diversion program at the time of the Columbine shooting for what?
Dylan and Eric were arrested for stealing some equipment from a van that was parked on a country road about 14 months before they died. That was the only time that Dylan had ever been in trouble. There was a spot in his junior year where he got in trouble. He was arrested. He got in trouble at school for scratching a locker and for hacking into the school's computer system because he was one of the school computer technicians. And it was a little cluster of trouble. Now, my take on that was I was extremely upset and concerned. I remember when he got arrested, asking everybody, what does this mean? Does this mean something? I talked to the diversion counselor. People kept saying to me, you know, Dylan is such a nice kid. You know, Dylan, this is out of character. These are growing pains, because Dylan presented as a normal kid. And as I look back, one of the symptoms of a change in mental condition is a change in behavior. And that cluster of trouble that Dylan was having was probably a flag that he was really struggling, really needed some help. But I didn't know that, and none of the experts that we were working with at that time knew it. I remember the diversion counselor asking him, do you think you need counseling? And he said no. They gave him his screening, and he got to fill out issues that were of concern to him. He did not check suicide. He did not check homicide. The only thing he checked was, I need a job and I need more money. So these are the kinds of things that nowadays schools and families are more alert to those kinds of changes. And I know if in some schools, for example, if Dylan had exhibited now what he did then, it probably would have been spotted if the school had a threat assessment program or a student safety program. Changes in behavior. I know Dylan fell asleep in a class, so that could be an indication. Something as simple as that he might be depressed. Any kind of irritability could indicate that a student is depressed. But those are kinds of things that, put together into a big picture, someone might have spotted that he needed help. But at the time, there were all these little indicators that different people were seeing, and no one put them into one big concept to see that these were signs possible that this kid was beginning to experience some depression, and he was starting to drown and needed help.
Sue, is there a chance that with the knowledge we have gained in the years since the shooting at Columbine, that we might overreact? And if so, is that okay?
Overreaction is, of course, a possibility. And I can't say, you know, across the board that overreaction is okay. Of course, it may not be. It depends on what the overreaction is. What I think the important thing to take away from this is, whether we see it or not, we must be aware that someone we love might be suffering, might be working very hard to keep that suffering behind a mask. And we should just be aware of that, because it will make us parent differently. I know in Dylan's case, no one had any idea that Dylan was capable of this, that he was having these horrific thoughts. And so something, for example, in the last weeks of his life, he wrote a very dark paper. The teacher told us, she showed it to the school counselor. But because of Dylan's personality and who he was, and he was soft-spoken and he was polite, no one thought that he was capable of what he did. But I think even though the chances that someone you love would do something like this are one in millions, the chances that someone you love may be struggling and may be suffering and may be having even suicidal thoughts, those odds are much, much greater. And we should all be aware of that at all times, and know how to talk to people, know how to listen, to not be afraid of asking them if they're thinking of killing themselves, if they wish they could go to sleep and not wake up, if they wish they were dead. These are conversations we should have with our loved ones.
In fact, we've had a talk with a couple of mental health experts at different times on the program, and have pretty well established, don't be afraid to ask. You're not going to get somebody to think about committing suicide if they weren't already, just by asking if they are.
That is a fear that is so widely held. School districts have it. Families have it. We're so afraid to ask if someone feels like they wish they were dead, or that they could die, or that they were planning to die. We are afraid that if we ask that question, that we are causing that to happen. And there is no evidence to support that. All the evidence indicates that asking the question is the most important first step in our being able to help them. The difficulty is, how do we react when we hear that answer? And that's where you talked about, you know, overreacting, and could that be wrong? The important thing to do is to listen, and listen without judgment, listen without freaking out, because of course you are terrified if you would hear something like that. Allow the person to talk, ask them questions about their feelings, keep them talking, because talking and identifying the feeling is the first step in helping them get better. And then connecting them with resources ultimately. But the first step is to listen and to ask and to not react with judgment, condemnation, blame. Make the assumption that if someone is talking about dying and wanting to die, they're in some kind of pain and they need help.
Sue Klebold is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the mother of Dylan Klebold. He and Eric Harris were the shooters at Columbine High School in April of 1999. The book she's written about that is called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. It is now out in paperback. She has donated all of the profits from the book to medical and mental health services. On the day of the shooting, your then husband called you with the news. What went through your mind as you were driving home?
Well, I was in an acute state of anxiety, and Dylan had just completed a diversion program. In fact, they had let him and Eric off early because they had completed the program with high standards, and they told us this is a really good thing. They hardly ever let kids off of diversion early. And he was in, you know, he had been accepted at four colleges that weekend before. He had gone to a prom with his friends. He had told me he had the best time of his life. He had picked out his dorm room for college, all within a few days before the shooting. So I was completely confused. I couldn't understand. There were no behaviors that I'd seen that could indicate to me that Dylan was dangerous or that he was planning to hurt others. I had no idea that the suicide was going to happen that day. I didn't know anything. So my thought driving home that day was, this is some kind of a prank, because Dylan had mentioned to me in a conversation a few weeks earlier that there was going to be some kind of a senior prank. And I said, Dylan, you can't take part in that because you just got off of diversion. And they said if you did anything, even put shaving cream on a banister, you would have a felony on your record. You know, don't get involved in any kind of prank, please. And then he said something like, don't worry, I know what I'm doing, or I wouldn't, you know, I promise you I won't get in any trouble, or something like that. So as I'm riding home, and I didn't have the radio on because I was trying to use all my concentration to drive safely, my thoughts were circling just wildly. I kept thinking, this is a prank, something has gone wrong, maybe they were doing some kind of theater, because he did take video classes, and he was did school plays. And I thought, maybe this is something that went wrong. Maybe they had guns that someone they'd borrowed, and they had live ammunition in them, and they didn't know it. And then I started wondering, maybe he's hurt. Maybe what's happening is Dylan has been shot. I mean, I was completely confused. I did not know what was happening. But I just knew that something awful was happening and that somehow this was going to change his life.
So one foot in front of the other, you can just continue to do what you can do. And you mentioned the fact that you think that we basically handle as much as we can handle at a time. We don't process any more than we can possibly handle.
Yes.
What gave you any solace or strength or any relief in those first days or hours after you knew what Dylan had done?
Well, there was very little solace or relief in those early days. When you are involved in a trauma like that, it takes everything out of your body and your mind. It is overwhelming. Your thoughts are so full of trying to process this information that you get lost. You cry constantly. It affects your ability to eat and sleep. Your memory, I would get lost driving. So those early days can only be described as hell. I don't know of anyone who's lost a loved one in any kind of anyway, especially a child, where you can think of it in any other way. Little by little, what began to emerge as helpful for me was I was surrounded by loving friends and family. People were very protective of us because, of course, the general public was blaming us for this tragedy. Our own governor went on national news to say this was the parents' fault. This is the fault of the childbearing of this person. So there was kind of an open season of hatred against our family, and people that I knew were very protective. And as time went on, I eventually got into therapy. I got connected with other survivors of loss. But yes, it was years and years of heartache and struggle, and it took a toll on me. I got breast cancer. I developed what is probably post-traumatic stress disorder. It was a severe anxiety disorder. There were just all kinds of things that happened.
You can only avoid news coverage so much then and up to the current day. I mean, after 18 years, do you feel like a more or less accurate account of what happened at Columbine that day has emerged?
I feel that a more accurate account has emerged over time. It was very early on what I could see, certainly locally, and it was that was kind of guiding what was perceived nationally, was that this was an issue of good and evil, that Dylan had not been raised properly. People made the assumption that Dylan was not loved. I even had people say that to me. Did you ever hug Dylan? And I went, of course. So yes, I think over time people are beginning to see this as brain health issues and that these are things somewhat beyond the control of someone outside who has not been educated about how to help.
We'll talk more about the brain health issues involved with Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, the Columbine High School shooters 18 years ago nearly. Sue Klebold was Dylan's mother, and she is the author of A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. We'll come back and talk more with Sue on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sue Klebold, who has a unique perspective on the Columbine High School shooting in April of 1999 because it was her son, Dylan, along with Eric Harris, who shot all those people, ended up shooting and killing 13 people, wounding 24 others, and then killed themselves. She's written a book about the journey that she has taken to understand what her son did back then. The book is called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. It is out in paperback as of just last month, and we are, by her request, not taking any phone calls on the Jefferson Exchange today. Sue, how much later did you find out about what Dylan had written, apparently 2 years before the tragedy at Columbine, about his own feelings, about wanting to end his own life?
Well, we didn't understand, first of all, what had happened on that day until 6 months after the shootings. That was when we got the police report, and they had finished their investigation. It took 6 months, and up to that point, in my mind, Dylan couldn't have hurt anybody on purpose or that he was shooting people accidentally. I had just had this denial. And then it was after that that they said, there are some writings, and they sent me copies of the writings. So it was after, and I don't remember exactly how long, but it was after 6 months that I really got to see what Dylan had written down and what he was feeling. And I was, it broke my heart, of course. A lot of what he wrote was very normal teenage angst. He was drawing hearts and writing girls' names and making poems and talking about love and wanting to have a girlfriend. But a lot of it was, you know, darker, sadder. It was very sad. And his writings should be shown in contrast also to the kinds of things that Eric was writing, because Eric's mental state was highly agitated, and he had a lot of images of violence and sort of graphic gore, and Dylan's writings were all sad and lonely and certainly indicated that he was feeling depressed, and that of course that made me feel more guilty than ever, because I thought, here he has not only done this terrible thing, but in the years leading up to it he was experiencing pain, and I somehow did not know that and was not able to help him. And that is one of the very difficult things to live with.
Had Dylan ever been medicated or suggested for medication by anybody who'd treated him?
No. And and he had never had any kind of a psychiatric evaluation. No one knew that he needed one, and no, he'd never had anything. The one thing we did find, I should say they found, because the police had been in his room after this happened and took a lot of things, but among the things they found in his room were a couple of bottles of St. John's wort, which is a natural kind of homeopathic antidepressant. So at some point in his life, he was trying to feel better and had used something like that, or had purchased something like that. I don't remember, you know, I don't know how many pills he actually took, if he took any, but there were two bottles that, they found among his things.
So everything points back, as you say, to his suicidal ideation, his decision to end his own life. And I wonder, in the research you've done in the nearly 18 years since the incident, what gets a person, though, from feeling their own life has no value to being willing to end other lives as well?
Well, and this is a, fortunately, a very rare thing. What we have to remember is that the statistical rarity of all the circumstances surrounding Columbine was significant. First of all, the fact that, you know, the two boys bond like this, and that there was a double suicide, that they both died. There was this almost chemical bond of their two, they were opposites in many ways, and that Dylan ended up allowing himself to follow and support and somehow work with this. I believe that, and I talked with a psychologist about this recently who worked with offenders, and she was, you know, her thought is, and I tend to agree with this, that when we have perceived victimization, that is the quickest route to violence. And I think that Dylan and Eric shared the feelings of victimization that had occurred because of bullying incidents in the school and the climate in the school. And I think that was enough of a trigger to create this outward anger and rage, in addition to the inner feelings that Dylan was having of self-loathing and being in pain.
There were lawsuits and depositions and all sorts of lawyers and courts involved in the years afterward. Have you met all of the victims' families, and is the legal action all completely done?
The legal action was all completely done and completed 4 years after the tragedy. There were people were suing. There were lots of lawsuits. I mean, the sheriff's department was being sued for failure to respond quickly enough. The parents were being sued, the parents of the boys. Eventually, and there were many more, but those are just a few, they were settled. There were insurance settlements, the money was pooled, and an organization of judges got together, and they tried to determine an equitable way to pool all the money and to give it to the various victims and the victims' families.
Have you met then many of the victims' families?
Oh, that was the other question. I'm sorry. I have met only a few of them. I understand that probably, I'm supposing here, that any contact with me would be very painful for people. I certainly don't know if I would have the courage to want to meet an individual's mother who killed my loved one. So I have never, other than writing letters to them, making public apologies, I will not invade their privacy or try to reach out to them out of trying to be thoughtful and protective and respectful of them. But that being said, there are some who have reached out to me and have we have met, we have talked. A couple of them I've become good friends with. So, yes, for those people who felt that would be beneficial and healing for them, they have reached out to me, and it has been a great gift, certainly, to me, and I am deeply grateful for their strength and their ability to do that.
Ultimately, Sue, Dylan Klebold's life was not just the last day. I mean, there was many years before that. I mean, do you even have an opportunity to remember him fondly now?
For many years, I did not. For many years, the image of him as a killer, the image of him that that he experienced, that I witnessed in the last moments of his life, sort of blocked out much of what I remembered about him. But it's been almost 20 years now, it'll be 18 years. And now, when I think of Dylan, I think of him as this sunny little child, and I smile, and I remember the good times we had. And he was a precocious darling, affectionate, playful model kid. He was very bright. He was in a gifted program. He had hobbies and friends, and I am able to remember those good times now. But it's taken a long time for me to sort of get to that place where I can smile and think of good memories.
Are there people who, rather than take the approach you've taken, that there were good things about him? I mean, he was your son, that there was a mental health issue there. I mean, are there people who just characterize it just in terms of evil and there was never anything good about him and you shouldn't think fondly about him?
I'm sure there are people who feel that way. But that is not something that I have any control over, or there's that, that's something that may exist, but I don't know that there's anything that I can do about that. I think it's the one thing that I see happening in society that I think is very dangerous, and that is when we group people and we lump them as good and evil, or we take some characteristic about them, such as their religion or their political beliefs or their skin color, those are the seeds of hatred. Those are the seeds, because in order to get to a place where you are able to kill and write people off, that kind of simplification and dehumanization has to occur. So I think that is probably the most dangerous thing we have in society, is that kind of thinking, that it's all this, and you take a small aspect of someone, who they are, and you magnify it so that one entity becomes who they are. We are all human beings. We are all capable of hurting ourselves and other people if we get to some kind of a crisis point where all the circumstances line up. And basically, we all want and need love, and we need people to listen to us and support us. And I believe that's true of all of us.
Sue, what is daily life like for you now, 18 years later? You have kept the name Klebold, which I can imagine still makes people's heads snap around in recognition.
It does. I'm just a gray-haired old lady. I just have a very quiet little life. I go to my neighborhood rec centers and have friends and, do yoga and take walks. And I just have I try to live a very purpose-driven life. I try very hard to focus on gratitude. I think one of the most important things we can do to stay healthy is to always, every day, focus on the things that we're thankful for. And it's a real exercise. It's not something that comes easily. But, if we sit down and start to think of every small thing in life that we have to be grateful for, it carries a lot of power and helps us view our world in a more positive way.
You have said that love is not enough to stop someone from committing suicide. So let's refresh again about what are some of the things people can do?
One of the things we can do is to ask how they're feeling, if they are feeling suicidal, and to listen and to keep them talking about this, to ask more about this. How long have you felt that way? Do you have a plan? How would you do it if you thought about it? And then to listen without judgment. Don't make assumptions that they're trying to get attention or that this is an irresponsible way to be or that, they're not pulling their weight or this is a coward's way to think. Don't make judgments about that, but listen. And then try to get them connected to help. Certainly the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is always available to us at 1-800-273-TALK. And to let them know that we are there for them. I think as parents especially, our job is not necessarily to make our children feel better, but it's to help them feel and to get some of these horrible feelings out and let them express it and know that we are going to be there with them through this journey, and we're going to help them, I think is a place to begin.
You've not only learned a bit about how the brain works in the last 18 years, but also about the people who work with the brain. I wonder what you make of the quality or quantity of mental health care in our country.
I think there is a a surge in mental health awareness right now. I think more and more people are beginning to understand that when they are having persistent thoughts of suicide, when they're experiencing thoughts and feelings that feel painful to them, that they need help. What I'm seeing is that I think the whole mental health care system is in a state of change. I think the people who work in it are heroic. A lot of times it's like trying to change a tire on a car that's moving at 60 miles an hour down the freeway. We're going to see a lot of changes in mental health care, and I don't know where it will all go, but I think a lot of it will be helping the systems that help us. For example, you know, school systems will play a role. The correctional systems must play a role. The medical systems must play a role. Family systems must play a role. And I think we're going to all have to do a better job of understanding what good health is. Remember that just because someone has a mental health condition does not make them dangerous. Most people are not dangerous. And certainly, if they are dangerous at all, it's most often to themselves. And we're going to be learning more about that and different ways to help.
So if somebody gets a yes to the question, are you thinking about hurting yourself, what's the first choice? I mean, it's obviously bigger than we can handle because we're not mental health professionals, most of us. What's the first place we should seek out help?
Well, there are different places to go. If you have, it depends on what state you live in.
Mm-hmm.
I know in Colorado, you know, we have crisis lines, and crisis line is a great place to take a first step because those are trained professionals who can evaluate. But there's also the National Crisis Hotline, the one I gave.
800-273-TALK. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And they are connected to local resources. It may need that the individual needs therapy.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on whether they're in a state of crisis or not. They may need hospitalization. But the important thing is to stay with it. Don't run from the question and listen and getting people
okay.
to talk.
Sue Klebold, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.